Hello, everyone. Welcome to the fifth episode of Pwn Talk, the only podcast that is dedicated to bringing amazing Pwn College discussions and contents right into your ears and live at your streaming platform of choice. I am Adam D, and I have with me two amazing Pwn College people. Why don't you guys introduce yourselves? Say hi.
Robert, go for it. I'll introduce you.
You can't. What? You have to. When I say introduce yourself,
that means
you go.
What if we both started speaking at the same time? You think we have the be a disaster? All right, this is Robert.
No, you're Connor.
All right, this is Connor, a.k.a. Kanak. Well, that's me. Yep. And then not Robert over here.
All right. I'm Robert. I'm frequently found on Pwn College and on the Discord. I'm Rob Waz.
Very cool. Well, we're very happy that you guys are here with us today. Let's see. Let's just pretend like we normally just do this, the three of us, and we don't have anyone else who normally joins us. I want to save that for later. But before we get into that, so the goal of today, what we want to talk about is the philosophy of design in Pwn College. And this is, I think, something that we'll be able to touch on over the podcast. This will be, I think, a recurring series. So what is the philosophy of Pwn College, Connor?
Well, I think there's a lot of philosophies, but
are they coherent in any way, shape, or form?
Probably not, but we try to pretend they are and figure out how to make them work together. I think when we first started, the first philosophy, well, I guess there's two immediate philosophies that emerged that ended up being maybe two of my PhD papers as I was working on Pwn College in a PhD sense. One had to do with the challenges, one had to do with the infrastructure. And, you know, putting my engineer hat on, that maybe the infrastructure is more interesting these days, but the challenges, unfortunately, are more important. But besides the point, one of the early philosophies we had discovered is that we didn't want to deal with people having a local environment and debugging all of the problems that go into that. And so that, like, driving idea led ultimately to the creation of the dojo, which I think we've talked about quite a bit in some past episodes. But that was immediately a very, just like, almost without so much thought, as a lot of our philosophies maybe are, decision was, you know, as soon as I tell someone with, you know, their Windows laptop that, you know, you need to change these BIOS settings so that you can get a VirtualBox to boot or something like that, I think right away in 2018, we just didn't want to deal with that problem. And so we immediately set up our infrastructure to be accessed remotely and being able to solve everything remotely. And then that has just kind of gradually expanded over time.
Right. So this was in the beginning, it was the challenges and actually like executing the challenges was on a remote system, right? But you still had to have analysis tools and everything locally, right?
Yeah. So
you can see through the evolution of the dojo how that design philosophy of essentially, I mean, if you could sum it up, is it something like we want it to be easy to approach solving these challenges.
Yeah, exactly. We want it to be easy to approach in a number of dimensions, one of which is just like the literal accessibility of starting the challenge and beginning your work. Like I don't want there to be any excuse for a student out there who says they're interested in learning cybersecurity to be like, well, I got stuck trying to install VirtualBox and then I gave up and so I didn't learn anything.
But
I think in our current form, you know, you can jump in and start learning something.
On the flip side, is there something to be said, though, of graduating with a CS degree and then getting a understanding when you're on the job market? You can say, yeah, actually, I do know about virtualization, and I was able to stand up my own VirtualBox instance to run Ubuntu on my Windows laptop, yada, yada, yada.
Yeah, it's an interesting trade-off where I don't know, again, how much thought went into it, but we decided to very aggressively lean into one side of that equation, which is there will be zero learning outcomes that have to do with learning how to set up environments. Maybe we could argue that our job was to teach security, not how to teach setting up environments. Obviously, the skills are interwoven in a certain sense. But yeah, we just immediately decided to skip that problem entirely.
Right.
Which it'd be interesting to see, you know, how much a student that comes out of Pwn College, maybe even a blue belt, do they struggle to set up, you know, a QEMU or something to get into a kernel environment to start debugging some kernel? I'm not sure.
Well, that I'd say definitely, but that's like on the far end of spectrum of skills you'd expect an undergrad CS student. Actually, the thing that comes to mind is when I was doing my undergrad, so much of the beginning stuff was in Eclipse. Like we were programming in Java, we were using Eclipse, and we fundamentally didn't really learn how build systems work, how like our Java code was actually compiled, probably until, I don't know, the third or fourth quarter, which was year 1 point, like really when we get to C and we learned makefiles, you kind of learn that there is this build system, there's this compiler that's happening, but really like you just got, I think they would even ship us like an Eclipse project. So there maybe would be some code for you, right? That was there and the build was all set up and you just hit this magic play button and then boom, your app would start running. And then if you wanted to debug it, there's a debug button, but fundamentally you weren't actually learning how. And I think for some people that actually like hindered their development as a software engineer because they didn't realize what was happening under the covers. So do you think there's a worry of like balancing?
So, I mean, somehow we are walking a line in here. So, for example, I think of, you know, 466, the beginning of Pwn College, and one of the primary things within, you know, all of that material is GDB, right? So there's been, you know, I have a bunch of ideas now that I say that. We immediately made it so people had to use GDB and figure out how to use GDB and, you know, couldn't get away with not understanding how to use GDB. And in general, there's caveats to this. In general, we don't make magic wrapper around GDB and just say like, oh, you can, you know, figure out how to debug stuff without using GDB because don't worry, we've done and made this like, you know, kind of fake program, you know, what is a fake program, but a non-standard program that kind of does that for you. Now, I say that, and then I realized that at some point we created the assembly crash course, which does not use GDB and does have fake GDB. So, you know, I guess...
Real debug instructions, though.
Yes, we make you use int 3 and then magically registers print their contents, which is... you know, maybe a non-standard behavior under any other, you know, workflow. But I think the initial goal with that, though, was that we saw debugging as very difficult. And so we wanted to kind of gradually introduce it. And I think we thought to ourselves that you didn't need too many debugging capabilities, maybe just as int 3 print the current state would be sufficient as you kind of begin to understand. I think we've since decided that's actually not a good idea, that we don't currently in our curriculum have this flushed out and built yet, but on the never-ending to-do list as part of our Computing 101 dojo is that we want to teach, basically we want to teach assembly and debugging simultaneously. So maybe in the beginning you don't use GDB, you use like strace or something because, you know, hopefully the debugging task you're going to do there, strace is sufficient. But I think, and again, it's not built out yet totally, we want to like interweave these together. I think we decided maybe the assembly crash course approach wasn't it. But all of this is to say in general, we use a lot of real tools, which maybe means like standard tools. I always joke that, you know, we're willing to bring a tool into our curriculum or a tool into even just a dojo in general if it has enough stars on GitHub. I think that's how I define a real tool.
Well, there's a second important thing.
Yes.
That there's a Nix package for it.
Yes, and then critically that there's a Nix package. Yeah, I think right now the only thing on the dojo that doesn't have a Nix package is anger management. And we wrote our own and I'm trying to get it upstreamed into Nix packages so that I don't have to think about that.
I want to say we added Bata Jeff recently.
Yes, that's a good point. Then that doesn't have that many GitHub stars, does it? No, but I'm wondering.
It is a very popular tool in our space.
Yeah, exactly. Well, there's exceptions to the rules.
So I learned Nix just so we could add that.
That's impressive. Yes. All right. So before we go down a Nix rabbit hole that we will save for another day, because I think that'll be a whole podcast itself. Robert, where do you come down on this? Like, just what we're talking about of like tooling and setting up your own tooling in your own environment versus using environment. Like, where do you see these distinctions?
So I understand the benefit of not having to struggle and stand up a virtual machine. But I believe that there's value in the friction. You learn what you don't know by having to stand up that virtual machine, or you get to touch things that are real. Like the more a platform or a learning tool puts things on rails, the more magic is happening under the hood that the user can't see. And we encounter that with, for instance, the assembly crash course nowadays, because we have more users on the platform, and they may have experience with GDB, and they try and use these kind of standardized tools because they don't realize kind of the magic that we're doing under the hood.
Right. There's an interesting, I think what's kind of coming up here, and actually literally part of the reason why we're doing this is this actually helps us, like talking about this stuff helps us formulate what our philosophy is and when to apply it and where. Part of it is, I think, you know, Connor mentioned setting up a virtual machine. And if you notice, the very example that he gave was setting up to debug a kernel extension, right? Which is a very real world use case of setting up virtualization that you might have to do on your side. Whereas getting started on some challenges, like setting up a Linux environment just to get started on challenges, that's orthogonal complexity to the goal of doing that specific thing. So like how, you know, going back to how I used to do 340 or how a lot of my assignments were done, you know, it was like, hey, your stuff's got to work on, in my day it was CentOS version, whatever, like what was ever on the giant server that we all had access to. And it's like, if you're running Windows, you better figure out how to run some Linux locally, or you use that slow server and figure it out. And so there's, I think, that mindset, which, you know, I definitely learned a lot from eventually running my own Linux systems, just like Rob was talking about. But on the other hand, that wasn't actually, you know, that wasn't like essential to the task of learning algorithms or learning data structures or just learning how to code, right? So there definitely, I think, seems to be the goal is like reduce the complexity and the necessary setup for things that are not critical. But for other things, I think, you know, what's critical over time may change. And that's what we, you know, realized, I think, with the GDB stuff is like, no, it's actually critical to teach them GDB so that they use it later, because that's a really good skill to have and to learn. And so that's why then going back, I think, to the assembly module, that was looking back, it's not the right decision of how to debug that challenge. Because maybe at the time it was useful, but now it's like, oh no, that's something essential that they should learn, and we should figure out how to kind of either co-learn those or make it, you know, work and useful.
I would say that there's a like a meta skill that you're trying to teach there, though. Like when you set up your virtual machine, and it may not be for the core task, it's still exposing you to something that you probably didn't experience otherwise. It depends on how you define the goal of the assignment, right? Is the goal literally just to know how to write some assembly, or is the goal to have a deeper understanding of computing and problem solving?
Yeah, that's a good question.
It's just tricky. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then when, if you look at it like as a long-term curriculum, not just in one module or one course, right? Where does that learning come from? Because I think there's, you know, I think there's enough stuff even now on Pwn College of Linux Luminarium and things that make you super familiar and used to a Linux environment that you should be able to stand something up locally to run and to play with. But maybe the difference is not being required and like having to do that.
Yeah, I guess like a tangential thing is it makes me think about, you know, sometimes we have these very railroady challenges where, you know, we're trying to teach a very specific thing, and it's just like the goal is learn that specific thing, and we don't want you to have to stumble through the other things. And sometimes just, you know, we mess up in writing the challenge. Like the challenge itself has bugs, which, you know, ideally it doesn't.
Dare you say that, sir?
Yeah, but it's very interesting that the type of student that is able to just overcome that, right? That is able to debug the infrastructure itself or debug and understand that like things aren't going correctly and they're able to reason about that and maybe even like solve around it. It is a very, it's almost like the ideal skill to teach, like the ideal meta skill. But there's this, you know, there's this balancing factor that, you know, on the other hand, if your goal is to teach assembly, I mean, the primary goal then is to learn assembly, right? It's not necessarily to learn these meta skills, but then somehow you need these meta skills to be woven in so that your general knowledge expands. It's a fun trade-off.
And going off of your example, Connor, right, that it's interesting that, you know, a lot of those students who would do that, they would easily set up the virtual machine successfully no matter what their BIOS settings and crap that they had to change and edit, right? Like, I think these are people that are used to working around obstacles, which is evident by the fact that they are working around infrastructure bugs. Cool. Okay, yeah. So I think, and the reason I really want to talk about this is because I think maybe people listening may think like, oh, well, this is just like a, I don't know, an educational philosophy or how you approach these things. But it's actually, I think there's another key thing that we want to get into is this notion of how do you design for different types of users, right? Like, so this is what we talked about, and Robert even was referencing that of saying like, well, yeah, somebody who does this who already knows GDB is actually like hampered when doing the assembly because they want to be able to use their GDB that they know, and they know it's a real thing, but now they can't use it because of this artificiality we've injected into this specific module. So maybe can we talk about how do you approach, Connor, and think about when you're developing, let's say, a new Dojo feature? How do you think about those different classes of users? Or maybe another way of thinking about it, if Zardes throws you a random PR, how do you think about the impact on these different classes of users?
These days, you know, if Zardes throws me a PR, we just YOLO merge it and say it's an experiment. Let's find out what happens. But ideally, when I'm thinking about it a little bit deeper than just that, you know, it's tricky. I think over the last 2 years or so, you know, I've been much more involved with CSE 365 and building out, you know, more and more introductory content. I know, for example, Jan's been very interested in the Linux Luminarium and Computing 101. I think there's almost like this grand vision of like, you know, a high schooler should be able to just start learning in Pwn College, which we have some high schoolers. And I think, you know, I put a lot of emphasis on this early learner. Like I almost try and imagine who is the person that knows absolutely nothing about computer science, has never done any programming in their life before. They just like, I don't know, they have some understanding of a computer because they've used like YouTube and Instagram or something, but beyond that, they don't know anything about computers.
Know what a computer is?
I do choose to assume they understand what a computer is, or at least like a tablet or something. I guess I don't care if it's a laptop.
Is an iPad a computer?
Desktop.
Good question.
Yeah, of course.
We'll table it for later.
As long as there's a web browser. See, that's the nice thing of building out this infrastructure where it's like all you need is a web browser. Beyond that, I don't care what's holding the web browser.
No. That's to access your thing, but their understanding of what a computer is and what it does, I think, doesn't translate as well. Like the concepts of directories in a file system.
Yeah.
If you've only used an iPad.
That's definitely true. Yeah. So we don't necessarily assume that. Yeah. That's kind of the point of the Linux Luminarium is, you know, we've been thinking more and more about the type of person that they know how to use a web browser, but that's it. They don't know, you know, all there is like a downloads folder. Anything else, like there's no file system. And figuring out how to build for that type of person. And as we discuss in a lot of our Pwn College meetings, this has various like educational limitations to it when you really focus heavily on the novice. It has various infrastructure limitations on it. You know, if I focus entirely on making sure that, you know, VS Code in the browser is a good experience, and I forget that, you know, half our users use SSH, there are issues that, you know, there's only so many hours in a day of building out improvements for people. And if I'm focusing all of my time on these more novice users, you know, in some sense, the expert users are getting left behind. Now, I think I justify it in my head that, you know, they're an expert user, so, you know what, they'll figure it out. But there are really cool things that we talk about that we could do for experts.
Yeah, and I think that's what, you know, you touched on a really important thing. Even thinking about this in terms of from a design or user experience perspective, right? When you're thinking about these two different paths, you have to weigh and consider the like maintenance burden of supplying these two paths, right? I mean, you hit on it, and we haven't mentioned it already, but there's three different ways to access Pwn College, which a lot of things, that's kind of insane, right? You maybe, I mean, I don't know. You said Instagram. You have an app for Instagram on your phone and a website, but like, maybe if you consider multiple apps, different types, but that's like, you know, SSH, VS Code, and the desktop. It's all kind of crazy that that is all functionality that has to work and be supported because they're so different, but they're each targeting like a different style of user. And even if not a different style, it allows users the freedom and learners to switch between whatever's best for them at the moment, at the time, for the challenge. And so do you have data on the different usages of the access mods, like access points?
I've looked at it. Yeah, we have various ways to probe it. You know, basically the enter someone's container, run PS aux and see if SSH entry point is running or VS Code is running or XFCE for the desktop is running. That's basically it. And if I remember right, it, something like, last time I would have looked would have been like a year or two ago, but it was something like 50% SSH, 40% VS Code, 10% desktop or something like that. And it makes sense because desktop is like, I don't know, most of the work in Pwn College are just using a terminal. Like VS Code just has a better terminal than desktop, which is just like showing you graphics. But then there are challenges, of course. There's a reason we have the desktop, which is if you need a GUI program, like you're not going to do that in VS Code or in SSH.
So some maybe slow people in chat are asking, literally don't understand, why not just desktop all the time?
You know, it's funny that this slow person in the chat, some professor, mentions that, because I actually, for like the last 3 years, up until like 6 months ago, I was exclusively using VS Code. And then at some point, I just like switched to desktop. And for some reason, now all I use is desktop. Now, most of my time is not spent actually solving challenges. It's like sanity checking that the dojo still works. So it's not really that good of a test, but I do actually find myself using the desktop a lot.
Is that just because of the complexity of the dojo, of the desktop is so much larger than everything else? So if desktop works, everything else likely works?
I think there's also like a bug on VS Code that needs to be fixed, as there's lots of bugs where sometimes it just black screens and you have to refresh the page. But I don't think I noticed this with the desktop. So maybe my brain has just subconsciously decided the desktop is more stable and I just click that button. I don't know.
Ah, this professor is not just slow, but lazy. So if you want to deploy games into the dojo, you need the desktop.
And that's the other author, or the other people that we build infrastructure for as challenge authors. So that's yeah.
So it allows flexibility, which actually came in during XAC CTF that we ran in 2024 for XAC. One of the challenges was a Tetris game, and so it's actually like, I think it was a reverse engineering, like kind of like a classic reverse engineering challenge. Like, here's a ROM. And you need to extract, I think you needed to play Tetris to get to some, you know, whatever, some high score or something. But the point was that usually you just give that ROM to the players and it's basically like, go F yourself, figure out how to run it. Kind of exactly like we were talking about, right? Run it yourself. Like your graphics libraries don't work on your Linux machine. Tough shit. Like, figure it out. Like, and so you're trying to do all this stuff and it can take a half hour or an hour to even run this stupid thing that they gave you. Whereas with by running the CTF on the dojo, it was so cool because you could actually go in there, start the challenge, and play the Tetris game inside of the dojo. So you did, because I made sure that that container already had all the stuff pre-installed. And so, yeah, it was actually really cool to that.
Yeah. And I just think of my like my own history with like playing CTF. As soon as I had like a graphical program, like the worst nightmare for me, like in a CTF challenge, is I see .exe on it. And then I learned that like I can't just wind it up and it's going to like try and launch something. And I'm like, all right, I don't care. I'm just going to a different challenge. I'm not setting up an environment for this.
Well, that's just because you're not a Windows head. You spent too much time in the Apple and Linux land.
Exactly.
Do you think Fish gives up if he sees a .exe? No, he gets excited.
There's definitely more resilient people than me, but as soon as I'm like, this requires environment setup, I'm out.
It's true. You need, like, and maybe it's kind of funny because this lazy and slow professor was during their PhD time, they were very they were like the main person who was developing the virtual machine that we would all use on Shellfish to play CTFs. So it had a, like, I believe it had Wine installed, also like a Windows, maybe it was Windows, and it had a versions of software that help you reverse engineer, and it had a bunch of tools installed. But anyways, and he would maintain this software, so and then send it all out to all of us, basically to reduce that setup burden on the rest of the team.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
I'm saying... The flip side of lazy, of course, is this random professor says it takes a lot of work to deploy games into the desktop. There's a whole games dojo, which I'm not sure what the educational outcomes are of the games dojo, but perhaps we shall find out. So, Robert, what are some other instances of the regular user versus power user trade-off on Pwn College?
So... One that like recently came up, I think yesterday in our meeting.
What? How timely and topical.
I know. Had to do with a PR that I don't know if it's been merged in yet.
Yeah.
Connor says
very
no.
Soon, though. It'll be here very soon.
But as a desktop enjoyer, it's probably a great feature.
Wait, are you a desktop enjoyer? Is that what you're just saying?
I am not a desktop enjoyer. And I do want to say for those that watch this after, you know, on YouTube, that while Adam D has surfaced, you know, these desktop enjoyer messages, there are SSH enjoyers in the chat as well. All right.
Boom,
you are seen.
Kelly Ovich, SSH is perfect.
Yes, it is. There is a UI feature that is in a PR where the desktop becomes like immediately accessible to the user. And that's great. It's less clicks for a desktop user to get the desktop in front of them. It's a lot more intuitive where they click start and what they need to do is immediately in front of them, right? Like it makes a lot of sense to a new user on the platform. It's very intuitive as far as what do I need to do? And I get to see something that's very familiar. If you're newer to computers or all you know is a web browser, as Connor kind of proposed. And when I saw this feature being demoed, the first thing that I thought was the amount of scrolling and clicking that is necessary as an SSH user. And the fact that I'm starting up this desktop automatically when previously, as Connor mentioned, I would only have SSH endpoint. Right, I would have this nice lightweight environment that just changed for me, and I didn't need to have a desktop. And so the perception on features that get added can vary quite a bit, whether you're a newer user that defaults to the desktop or you are someone that is, you know, an SSH head or lives in the terminal.
Nice. Yeah. Okay. So Connor, is as the token as what are you, Zillennial or whatever, Gen Zer? Is this the time where I engagement farm and I say, hello, chat, why don't you write into the comment section or the chat what you prefer, desktop or VS Code or SSH? We would love to hear from you.
It would be interesting, to hear who likes what and why. Because, you know, to me, if I was a standard student, I think VS Code is where it's at. It's kind of
you think it's because that's what they're used to, because VS Code is honestly kind of like a standard IDE now.
You know, I think in general it's becoming more. It should become the default even quicker. I'm surprised it's not the default even quicker. Every once in a while, I see someone like using Nano or something, and I'm like, "What happened in your CS education that led you here? Is this just like the first command you ran, and then you just started learning it, and then you just never looked beyond? What happened there? You know?" But VS Code just works very well. So yeah, it should be the default.
We're getting that was a Gavagen Farms. The comments are coming in. The debate is raging within our comment section, or what do we call this? The chat in chat.
Yeah,
people
exactly.
are fighting. Wait, hey guys, calm down. You don't, it's okay. What's wrong with Nano? Yeah, that's a great one.
The other interesting thing in terms of like developing Pwn College and building out the dojo is that SSH, there's room for features actually for the SSH stuff. But because it's not in the browser, and like it inherently is not in the browser, right? Like I can put a terminal in the browser, but I'm not putting SSH in the browser, right? Like the whole point is that you can use your own terminal SSH at us and, you know, use your own local terminal stuff. It means like I can't develop around it, right? Like it's just this external program you're going to use to mess around with the dojo. Whereas as soon as it's in the web browser, I have like full control over curating that experience. You mentioned that there's three ways to access a challenge. That's actually not true anymore. There is at least a fourth, but realistically, there's an infinite number in recent evolution of the dojo, which is you can just access any web service running inside of your container. So from an infrastructure perspective, you run XFCE as a desktop environment, and then run NoVNC as like the browserified layer so that you can actually access it in your browser, or we run VS Code in the browser. But both of these things are just running in your workspace environment, which makes sense because you want to be able to like run commands in your workspace environment, which means those things need to be in the workspace environment. And all it does is it just like iframes something in your workspace. And so like, I think it was last semester, we added, you know, back to thinking about the more introductory type of student, we added the lecture challenges, which is the our answer to how do you make sure people watch lecture videos? And, you know, there's a question of whether or not that's a good idea and blah, 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 blah. But ultimately, we decided it's a good idea. We're going to make people watch lecture videos. And all that is a web service running inside of your workspace that isn't VS Code, isn't the desktop, is something else, and just handles all of the logic to try to make sure you're watching the video and then give you the flag at the end. And at this point, you can do that for any service, like anything that can be a web server. Right now in Pwn College, there's a way to just like say, I want to access port 4242 in the workspace and make a HTTP GET request there and give it back to me. And so like we've kind of expanded the idea of what it means to access the workspace. Like for Linux Luminarium, we have some ideas related to the feature that Robert was talking about that'll be in the dojo hopefully in the next week, which is, you know, maybe you don't need the desktop or VS Code. All you need is a terminal. And you might say to yourself, oh, just SSH. But people don't always just SSH. We just need a terminal. Like, I should be able to hit start and then type cat/flag, hit enter on level one of the Linux Luminarium, and just be done with it. And so what we want there...
Did you just spoil level one of Linux Luminarium?
I did just spoil level one. I know. It's the dojo's getting easier and easier, and we're going to have to wipe this VOD now. It kind of, like, I think about a challenge isn't just a program. It's like, it is like an environment, like you're accessing something. Like in theory, there's challenges that don't even need a Linux environment, that just implementation-wise have a Linux environment, like the lecture challenge. And I imagine like these cool high school-focused challenges or middle school-focused challenges where, you know, maybe you really need to do the thing that I said we don't want to do, which is like, you know, if we want to teach debugging, we want to teach GDB. But maybe for a middle schooler, GDB isn't the answer. I don't know. And maybe you want this more like graphical thing that's showing like this instruction and this instruction and this instruction and like hopefully there's a cool thing that already exists. We don't have to write that ourselves. And then we could just like deploy that in the workspace, and like that'll be their way of viewing it. You never get to type LS, which is sad, but like for the learning outcome we're going for, it's okay. You know, so this is some of the stuff I think about with the dojo.
Geet, yeah, I think Linux in the sun. Go ahead, Rob.
That sounds like the same trappings of the assembly crash course, Connor.
It could be.
Where it's super convenient and it's easy to get it right, but it's hard to learn from getting it wrong. Right? Like having the real Linux environment and typing the wrong command and getting that error message or being on a real system like adds a lot of value. Because when you do make mistakes or you click on the wrong thing, there's a sense of discovery, a sense of this is tangible and real. And the more you abstract away from that, it is easier to find the happy path, but you gain a lot less going the road not taken. Or the road not taken is simply not available, right? Because you've kind of directed the learner to the happy path.
Yeah, it's interesting. I would say, you know, it would be really cool to run an experiment, you know, in like a middle school classroom and see like, how do they do just SSH'd into some Linux box to learn assembly versus like, you know, graphical thing and like fireworks go off and like, you know, TikTok brained style of education and give them the same test at the end, right? There's a way to build this study and see who does better at the end. That would be very interesting because my worry is like a middle schooler is going to see like text box and like just a bunch of text and some of them might enjoy it, but maybe a lot really won't. I don't know.
Yeah, or I think the other thing it makes me think about is making the platform more general purpose, right? So rather like, you know, I've always kind of thought, how do you take it even lower, right? How do you teach, even if it's not, let's say, assembly or programming, but security concepts, adversarial mindset, I think privacy is one thing. Like you could teach those to non-technically minded people, actually kind of through games, I think is maybe the way that could go, but something like that where you have some environment where they are interacting with it and they get to actually practice either breaking somebody's privacy or seeing like, I don't know, maybe it's a thing where you can mess with people's phone and you can see that somebody with a really bad, you know, PIN code, you can just easily get in and see all their pictures and everything. Or like the location tracking stuff. Like I remember one of the cases I loved with the Pokemon Go was a case where somebody found that their boyfriend or girlfriend or whatever was cheating on them because they had caught a Pokemon at their ex's house. And because that location data was logged and they could see that in Pokemon Go, they inferred their location from there. So challenges where maybe you give them access to this information is like, all right, figure out where these people are, right? Put them in adversarial situations, but without maybe to get them either aware of that. I think even if they don't go into security or computer science, it's important to be aware of these concepts. And on the flip side, if it does spark something in them, we can kind of have a path for them forward to get more technical and hands-on.
Yeah, exactly. I think there's just some challenges that maybe a Linux terminal isn't the right access modality to it.
Like Mac challenges?
No, like for example, it's kind of a silly challenge, but like the lecture watching challenge, right? And maybe the solution there is called like just go use Canvas or something and don't try to implement this on the dojo. But I think there's challenges where it's just the natural thing isn't a Linux terminal.
ASCII Cinema exists.
That's wow, true.
Wait, have you tried watching one of these YouTube videos in ASCII Cinema?
We should do that. We should support SSH for these lecture videos. That's a good idea.
All right, horrible features brought to you by PwnTalk. The next time you're in the dojo and you see insane Jan in a video, you'll know where that came from in your SSH terminal. Cool. Okay, so then I think the other thing I want to touch on is we have this notion of these different users, right? And it's definitely something we think about when we add a feature, right? We kind of talk about, okay, is this going to benefit like beginner users? Is it going to benefit more power users is the way I think of it. And the really important reason why I want to bring this all up is that in interface design, this is actually a very key component. And a lot of times until you take a class and study this, you don't usually think about it. Like one key thing with a lot of software is like key bindings, right? Like keyboard shortcuts. If you are a frequent user of those, many, many people do not use that. Like 80% of people don't use any keyboard shortcuts. But for those 20% of power users, they like absolutely rely on that to get their job done faster. And so if you mess those up or take those away from people, they now can't do their job as well and they get really pissed. So I think that's what I really like about this is another instance of having these different types of users that maybe the power users are smaller in number, but what they use is different and helps them be more effective. My question to both of you is, how does this concept of regular user versus power user apply? Like, does it apply universally? Like, are we looking at this in every aspect of Pwn College and the content, or are there contextual aspects to it? Like, let's talk challenge design. Like, when you're developing a like reverse engineering C image module or Linux Luminarium, are different things in your mind than when you're developing the wormable network exploitation, like brown belt level material?
I think the answer is obviously yes.
With the Linux, so. Trying to tee it up.
Maybe I could have found a way to say no and rationalize that, but I don't see the path to that. I think the answer is yes. So it's very interesting. The thing that comes to mind, which it makes sense, is CSE 466 at ASU versus CSE 365. And my first like introduction to CSE 365 started in 466, and then we gradually expanded 365 to be Pwn College style, blah 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 blah. And we just had a totally different user base, which I think we talked about in a previous podcast, the whole idea of a required student versus optional, that whole discussion. But there's another thing that comes out when you go for like this breadth model of education, which is what CSE 365 is. We go for a lot of topics and try and do a good job teaching a lot of topics. But ultimately, when you go breadth, you're not going depth. You can't do breadth and depth. I mean, as much as we try in 365, and students probably think we're doing breadth and depth, we could go a lot deeper on these topics. And so what that means is that like breadthness coupled with being more introductory means we have to design challenges where maybe our median student, I like to think a lot about like, who is my median student in 365? And I'm theoretically writing the challenge for them or writing most of the module for them, most of. And it needs to be a lot more, the concepts need to come more bite-sized than they do in 466, or at least previous iterations of 466. And the other issue is by having so many topics, in 466, one of the really big, like, overarching things, at least as I saw it back in, like, 2022, 2021, was GDB. Like, GDB just, like, in some sense, like, GDB was the class. Whether you're doing, like, ROP or memory corruption or reverse engineering or a lot of the topics, not necessarily all of them, but a lot of the topics, it's, like, figuring out how to effectively put yourself in the mindset of using GDB. A lot of those modules were built as like, you wanted to learn memory corruption, learn reverse engineering, but it's like, it's almost like a canvas for learning GDB and learning how to think about problems and debug problems. And like, I've got this assumption, I need to, clearly something's wrong because I haven't solved it yet. I need to invalidate something in my thinking and really embrace this. And I think those ideas are somewhere in the core of 365 still, but it's a lot harder because we can't just let there be a semester of GDB and like you get comfortable with like maybe this GDB view into that way of thinking, even though you're exploring all these different topics. Because, GDB just isn't relevant in network security. It isn't relevant in web security. It isn't relevant in cryptography. It is relevant, of course, in our binary security portion of it. But then in web security, like the lens of figuring out how to debug things is different than cryptography, which is different than network security. Like, I need to figure out how to think through, like, oh, I should be running TCP dump on all of my different interfaces and that. And like, this is one way of debugging that. And there's this core idea there, but you're not able to get this tool sharing, which means you don't develop enough experience because we only have 2 weeks to go into this topic, which means we can't rely on it for like later in the course, which means we need to be like more handholdy because like we don't have enough time to fully develop like in the first half of the semester, these skills that hopefully are concrete by the second half. And it's just like a very interesting challenge working in a breadth class that's introductory. And I think that's one of the kind of the reasons I think about that thinking about this type of student is just so different than thinking about a 466 student.
Right. It makes sense, right? Because I think of 365, yeah, like I think breadth is a good thing, or of like looking at it like cybersecurity, the different areas, right? You're kind of poking at each of them, but there's, you know, the commonality is probably adversarial thinking and this type of mindset, but the application domains are so different that it is hard to bring skills over from one to the other. Similar thing happens in web security, just because you're like, oh great, now you're doing SQL injection. Well, great, now you have to learn about databases and SQL, and then now you're learning cross-site scripting, and now you need to learn about JavaScript and HTML and how all this stuff works. And then you're learning command injection. Well, now you need to learn Ruby or Python or whatever that thing is, or PHP. Like, there's a lot, you know, when I did grad web security, that was definitely something that I noticed, is like, there's just a large breadth of things. And that was a master's class, so I could be like, well, you got to catch up. You either know this stuff or you don't, or you're going to learn it. And that's just how it is. On the flip side, though, you said 466 was a GDB class, but I know several blue belts that hate GDB and did everything statically.
That's true. That is true, which is unfortunate.
Well, unfortunate for them, because understanding how programs work is a very good skill that is really the core of debugging. Like, that's what you're trying to, it's like a problem solving thing. Like, there's some problem. What tools do I have? How can I get the information that I need in order to like edit, like validate my hypotheses?
And exactly. And like, this is where like the computer science, the science part really shines in computer science. I feel like when I'm just thinking like back when I was an undergrad at ASU, and I was like, why is this called computer science? Like, this, like, it seems so like, I don't know, like people are like making it fancy for no reason, right? But I think through Pwn College, I've learned that, you know, computer science really is a science. Like, almost all of the tasks are invalidating hypotheses. Like, that's what debugging is. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, at the root of all of this, you could say like critical thinking is the commonality or something. But ultimately, what I've seen is being able to learn how to critically think and be good at critically thinking, it's a spectrum that I think a lot of people, and it makes sense, rely on a certain level of like comfort with the task they're working on. And like, once you have like this instinctual ability to use GDB, that you're not like thinking through GDB syntax, you're just like, I know I want to stop at this point in the program and like investigate what the value of this register is. And you don't need to like, you don't even spend like 90 seconds figuring out the syntax for that again. You can just do that in like 3 seconds. Like, that shortening that thinking ability allows you to apply critical thinking faster. And this is where like the magic starts to happen.
Robert looks like one he's of the, blow you
as
up,
I said, but unfortunate things with 365 is we just are hitting so many topics. It's hard to like build that familiarity to be able to do that.
I'm going
to
hit you with, I believe it's a Connor quote. I myself, I don't know where it is, but I know some users on our Discord have embraced it. And it immediately came to mind when you were talking about how GDB provides you this nice, comfortable place where you can kind of rely on, right, in 466, which is kind of true because we are in the same domain, right? But a great Connor quote from one iteration of 365 is, one of the most important skills in learning is how to become familiar with the unfamiliar. And I think that's a fantastic quote. And I think that is, like, when you talk about critical thinking, particularly when it comes to cybersecurity, that is a huge skill set because you are constantly looking at something that is foreign or unfamiliar.
Now, on the flip side, while you were talking, Connor, I'm like, well, now we have AIs that I can just say, how do I do this in GDB? And honestly, there's been oftentimes now I'm using like a ChatGPT instance, like where I would use Google to be like, how do I do this? Like I need, like when I editing these podcasts, sometimes it's like, okay, I want to do an FFmpeg to like generate an FFmpeg command to convert to like 720p from whatever 1080p or something. And it's just like, boom, here's the command. And I'm like, great. I don't want to learn FFmpeg syntax because it's stupid. Or extracting, you know, audio files from the videos and stuff. And it's just like, it's kind of interesting that it may be this bridge between your thinking and what the tool does.
Yeah. The concern is that like these challenges are a playground for you to experiment with ideas and like think about where things fail and then like deal with the fact that it failed. The issue is like LLMs can just sidestep a lot of that. And then you don't build up this familiarity with the unfamiliar. I mean, you do in a sense. It's like, I just type to OpenAI or to ChatGPT, and that is how I am familiar with the unfamiliar, is that I can just know how to speak English and express some sort of problem to it, and then hopefully it says something insightful. But it makes me think of like elementary school, where the teacher says, like, you're not allowed to use calculators on this test or whatever for your long addition or long multiplication. And like in the moment, you're like, this is stupid. Like, I should just be able to use the calculator. But then they're like, is something there? And then this like goes into like, you know, calculus in high school. And like you can use some calculators, but you can't use the one that can do like the symbolic, you know, the caste system or whatever. And I feel like the LLM is, the world doesn't know what to do with LLMs yet in education as much as you maybe think that, like, oh yeah, obviously educators just know what to do with LLMs. Like, they really don't, because like there's value to the LLMs, and like LLMs are going to be a part of the future workflow, and like so you should learn how to use them. But it goes at like this math idea. Like, we've had algebraic calculators, caste systems, but like in calculus you don't use it, and like there's a reason you don't use it.
Because they're lazy.
It's something I think about. Maybe it is. Maybe it's just they're lazy.
I don't think they are. I was just kidding. But yeah. If you really want to try to shorten that gap, right? If you just imagine that, like, okay, you're working on a challenge and you say, great, let's set a breakpoint on main, rerun that. Okay, we're here. Let's examine this memory region. What does that look like? I want it in hex. And like, okay, let's step forward to this line. Great. Okay. Now let's examine this. How did the stack trains? I'm not saying like solve it, but like as an interface to these arcane tools like GDB.
I agree with that, like for example for myself, but then you might wonder like why not, but for the students also. But like, do the students know that that's the workflow? Like, set a breakpoint here, and like there's a like why do you want to look at it in hex? Like, there's a reason. We might instinctively be like, oh, the right way to look at this is hex, but there's been like something that's developed and we've gained experience that like this is a workflow that has worked for me in the past and it'll probably work here. That if you just LLM your way through everything, you don't even have any idea of the workflow. So like, how do you even know to express what you want?
Just like, what is the point of typing in GDB syntax? I'm really just thinking about the input mechanism. Like, if the only thing the LLM did was translate what you said into GDB syntax and then you hit enter.
Yeah. No, I know that that's what you're saying, but how do you know that like a tool in the GDB tool belt that you might want to reach for is breaking at a certain point in the program? Like, how do you develop that instinct?
How did they do it now without, like, you have to teach them the syntax is going to do these things, and then you have to teach them why they want to set breakpoints on certain things. Like, you still need the why, you just don't necessarily have to teach them the how.
Yes.
And maybe that would be better for learning.
Teaching the why, though, without the how, though, it's not clear. Somehow these things are, like, connected, right? Like, at least in our model of education, where it's, like, challenge-based learning, it's, like, we give you something that you need to overcome. And if the LLM can just overcome it, you're done.
another thought experiment. So I would argue people are probably better at debugging when they use tools like GDB and also with cybersecurity stuff than most developers that use GUI-based debuggers. And I don't know why, but...
Yeah, exactly.
I think there is...
These people that are, like, willing to struggle with something more, and then, like, we know that in the end, you might be struggling more in the beginning, but, like, the workflow will be so much smoother in the end. It's like learning Emacs or something, or for the crazy people that use Vim. It's like, in the beginning, like, that's painful. It's like, this is not smoother than just using, like, text editor, right? I can just type space a bunch of times and curly brace and click over here and like be done with it. But somehow in the end, after fighting through this pain, it's just, it is better.
Thoughts?
Oh, terminal tools tend to be more expressive than GUI tools. GUI tools make the things that you want to do, typically want to do, the common tasks easier to accomplish because they're visually in front of you. But with a terminal tool, whether it's Vim or GDB or Awk or Sed or, you know, anything that is primarily in the terminal, there's a huge cognitive load. And if you have the right mental model that matches the way that that tool expresses those concepts, then you can more easily map what's in your head to what is on the screen, where you can't do that with a primarily graphical program, typically.
I think that's fair. Plus, there's like overhead. I mean, that's a classic user interface thing of, which I think, was that when you took my class, Connor, that I would talked about the keyboard versus mouse?
You had a whole day on like how to save fractions of a second or something. I forget. There's some meme in there.
Yeah, you could, if those people followed that advice now, what is it, a decade later, Connor? You can tell me how much time that saved for you.
But you have like a slide where it's like, oh yeah, you can click in 0.1 seconds, but you can type in 0.001 seconds. And so like moving your hand, like I was like, what the heck is going on here?
Yeah, it's literally, actually, it's what we're talking about is what I took a user interface, like a HCI class, human computer interaction class. And that's one of the things that you study in addition to like power users, regular users, this kind of thing. So it's something that's still stuck with me from my undergrad days that I was happy to teach on. And actually, Rob, I think when you were talking, I noticed something very interesting. I was internally nodding my head at everything you said that is a tool that I used. And then when you went to Sed and Awk, I shook my head and said, fuck no, nobody should ever learn those things. It's too arcane, but it's just the ones that I don't know, right? Like,
okay, grep?
Yeah, grep. See, exactly. Sed, okay. Awk, no, grep. Boo.
Yeah, never Sed. Well, sometimes in a script that needs to like patch a program, you have to Sed, because Sed is like the Dockerfile text editor. And then Awk only for print $1. That's the only reason to use Awk.
That's what I was thinking. But this is actually another thing that LLMs are good at, like with that I actually would use them for, is to be like, okay, I need to extract some complicated thing. Give me a command line. And if it spit out an Awk script, I would probably just run it. And if it worked, it would work and that'd be great. But I would never know how to take it apart. Oh, man. All right. Well, I think we've had a great discussion, but before we go, there's something very important that I need everyone out there to do. So I teased this at the start of the show. So Jan is not with us today for very happy reasons. Zardes is celebrating his mother's birthday. So to also juice our numbers, but also I want everyone to drop in chat or DM Zardes or something and tell his mom happy birthday. Because we would not have the Zardes that we know and love without his mom. And so we want to make sure she has a very happy birthday. So, you know, great reason for not being here with us and talking to all of you. So I want to see, the comments just fly past so much that I can't even like read them. It's so crazy with the 20, 30 people that are out there.
Yeah. Happy birthday to Zardes' mom.
Boom. Yeah, allegedly they're, I don't know if they still are. I probably should have done it at the top, but they were watching the stream together. So maybe that's still happening. All right. So we will be thinking about new features that come up in the dojo. I think this is something we'll probably talk about like in the future when we talk about new features and developing them of how it impacts regular users and power users, because this is something that we definitely, it's on our mind. Final closing thoughts, Robert. Who should we optimize for? Let's go with that. Who should we optimize for?
Power users, 100%. No GUI, no VS Code. Go back to the glory days of just a raw socket exposed over the internet.
Kotick?
The more I think about it, we got to make the experience good for like high school students, middle school students. You know, the median student, maybe the 75th percentile student, but the power user, they'll figure it out. You know what? These people complaining about stuff, the browser is just executing like HTTP requests. You can go figure out how to write a better client upon college yourself.
Nice. And my official stance is we should be optimizing for me. Whatever is better for me, Adam D, that's what we should do. All right. Well, thanks, everyone, for joining us. This is Pwn Talk. We will probably not be here next week because it's so close to DEF CON. But catch us. We will be at DEF CON running DEF CON Academy, which we talked about 2 weeks ago on our last episode. We got a lot of really cool stuff. We'll be at the AICC thing. We'll be in the CTF room. So please come hang out with us. Say hi. And see y'all next time.
Goodbye.